Session number 20119, Reel 3.
Colonel Gibbon, Reel 3.
And I was on detachment in a small village 40 or 50 miles north of Bergen. So I don't recall any of this in detail. It's all I've given you was hearsay entirely.
Coming back to that period when you were doing the recce work in front of 15 Div, any incidents that happened to you on that?
Not that I recall, no. Not to me personally.
What was the attitude of the German population towards you?
Oh, I think cowed, could be said. The German civil population were very fearful, especially when they saw this particular regiment wearing red berets, which they were, had a terrific amount of propaganda about the red berry soldiers, the airborne soldiers.
Did they expect you to be committing atrocities?
I think they probably did.
How did the SS men behave in practice?
Absolutely without... impeccably. I should think there was a certain amount of looting went on, things like weapons and cameras and binoculars, but no more than that.
What happened to you after the end of the Second World War?
When the regiment was disbanded in Colchester, I found another friend of mine, who was always great for doing things with friends, a chap called John Notley, who was a regular soldier and a friend of my cousin's. And I went as a staff learner to HQ Essex Subdistrict in Colchester. And after 6 months or so, he passed me out as being reasonably efficient. And I was posted to the British military mission in Bucharest in Romania. Where I stayed for the next year, and that was a fascinating bit of my story, because we were a military mission. We were a liaison group with it was in the Russian-controlled territories. There was a Russian mission, obviously, commanded by Marshal Zhukov. There was a British mission commanded by an Air Vice Marshal. There was a French mission and a United States mission. And I was a G3, General Staff Officer Grade 3 in the thing. It was an extraordinary time in the war. One had suddenly come out of it. It was Romania was well behind the Iron Curtain, so to speak, although that phrase hadn't been coined yet. We were supplied by air from Bari by the Royal Air Force, who flew in about one plane a week or something. There was a small RAF detachment with, they had a German training aircraft, a thing called a Klemm, low-wing monoplane, which they had to fly so many hours each month to continue to receive their flying pay. And the squadron leader had been an ex-flying instructor, and he taught me to fly. Which was enormous fun. I didn't awfully like whiskey in those days, and he taught me to fly for my monthly naffy bottle of whiskey. It was peculiar because we had to get clearance from the Russians every time we took off and landed, which was normally only given once, so I'd learnt rather advanced aerobatics before I'd ever learnt to land properly. But eventually I did, in fact, go solo once. And, of course, my solo flight coincided with the arrival of the one-a-week aircraft from Bari. So I remember, to his horror, he told me afterwards on the ground, and mine in the air, I had to go round and round twice before the airfield was clear to land on. But I eventually got down with a fearful bang. We went out. A lot of the job was going out touring the country. A lot of it was, in fact... so to speak, spying on a minor level on the Russian army. And in those days, you could identify, I don't think I could, but the experts could identify which unit the Russian the particular vehicle you saw belonged to, so you could eventually build up an order of battle, Russian order of battle. And so whenever you went out, you had a pencil and paper on which you wrote down the numbers of the Russian lorries that you passed and where you passed them. And I remember I'd got a Leica camera, which I'd bought, and I was taking photographs of the Bulgarian border, which was entirely unremarkable. It just was the Bulgarian border. There was nothing to see at all, but I was then arrested by the Russians, who accused me of taking photographs of a military zone. Well, there was nothing to show it was a military zone at all. I remember it was rather a quiet sort of meandering river. But they took me off and interrogated, and I've managed to destroy the notes that I'd taken. I think I ate them, actually, in true Philip Oppenheimer style. But I was interrogated in German, the only common language. I don't think I've ever spoken German better before or since, but I was released, but then I was persona non grata from then on and was flown out to Vienna, where I eventually went back to my regiment and joined the 2nd Battalion in Jerusalem, eventually.
This is the RIF?
The Royal Irish Fusiliers. They don't like being called the RIF, the Irish Fusiliers.
Sorry.
It doesn't exist any longer, actually. It was taken over and formed the Royal Irish Rangers, and now it's part of the Royal Irish Regiment. And joined the 2nd Battalion of the Irish Fusiliers in Jerusalem, where I took over command of the support company.
Just coming back to Romania, mm-hmm. How did the Russians conduct that interrogation?
Oh, it was just a Russian major sitting opposite me across a table in a small room, as best I remember, for about an hour, asking me what I'd doing, but I'd managed to, they were fairly unsophisticated in those days, I'd managed to take the film out of the Leica at the back and expose it. And so they couldn't see what I'd been taking. And as I say, I destroyed all the evidence.
Which year would this have been?
I think 1946, about.
So what story did you give them?
Oh, I was just passing along. I had no idea it was the Bulgarian frontier. I was just passing along. I was on tour, seeing what it was, and doing it. But I was expelled almost immediately, because at that time I think I was in fact taken off G3 duties and had been made ADC to the Air Vice Marshal, which was very interesting indeed, because one met all the people of note in the country, King Michael, who at that stage was still on the throne, Marshal Zhukov, who I think commanded well over 1 million men, you know, in the assault on Eastern Germany. And I was responsible for his household and the dinner parties and things, which was complicated because one had to, because we were a mission, we were had diplomatic status, and therefore it was important to seat people at dinner with regard to protocol, their seniority, but at the same time they had to have a language in common, which was exceedingly difficult to work out how to arrange seating plans, I remember. But I had a few words of the various languages, only a very few words, which were jolly good. After one gin, I was fluent in quite a number. With two or three gins, I'd had it.
What was Zhukov like?
A short, thick-set little man, as far as I remember, who'd said very little. But I was only sort of introduced to him, click your heels and bow over his hand. I mean, again, I was very junior, but one saw from afar.
What were conditions like in Romania at that time?
Raging inflation. The rate of exchange went, the pound gained on the Romanian lei, LEI, weekly, the exchange rate changed, and one was looking back rather ashamed the way one did one shopping on the day it changed. To gain, one bought Leica cameras for very little indeed. And one led the life of perhaps an occupation army. I mean, we had we lived in little houses, ordinary townhouses, around messes of about half a dozen officers. Four or five officers, perhaps, And each mess had a villa on the lake just north of Bucharest, Lake Snagov. And we had access to dragon boats. I mean, all, I suppose, taken from wealthy Romanians. So one led quite a life.
What was the attitude of Romanians towards you and towards the Russians?
Again, I think pretty cowed. The war hadn't been over very long. And the Romanian division, I can't remember its name, the Black Guard, had fought on the Russian front. And that, of course, was the Russians' excuse to come and occupy the country. And what they wanted, of course, was the oil from Ploiești, just north of Bucharest. But it was fun. I mean, we skied in the winter in the Carpathian Mountains. We shot duck and things on the Danube in the summer. But I only had one winter and one summer there, of course, you know, before I was found out and sent back.
What impression did you get of the Russian army?
I thought they were, never knew the soldiers. One didn't see them at all, they were just headquarters. And one met very few Russian officers. But they were rather nice, we thought, on the whole, I think. We didn't have much language in common, and I think some of them could speak French a bit, but not much. But we didn't, in fact, they were very fearful of the West in those days, we didn't, in fact, see very much of them. I'm sure at higher level they did, but not at my level.
Can you tell me what happened to you in Palestine with the Royal Irish Fusiliers, please?
We were in the Syrian orphanage in Jerusalem with my company and another company. And it was a question of stopping and searching. I don't recall any particular actions. Stopping and searching and checking generally on movements and trying to hold up the work of the Haganah and the IZL, who were fighting to get the British out and release the mandate, which they eventually, of course, did. By that time, I'd changed over and I decided that I wanted to go to staff college and be a staff officer. And I'd changed over and got myself, I'd gone back to England on a course. And changed while I was away. My company was taken over by another chap, quite rightly, but as he was 3 days senior to me, he retained the company. So I went off to be a G3 of the 3rd Infantry Brigade in Sarafand, and was there when the time came for the mandate to end. And the British troops left. We left by road all the way down from Sarafand, which is in the middle of Palestine, about fairly near Tel Aviv, to the Egyptian border. And my job was on the brigade rear link to the battalions. And before I'd even left the square in Sarafand, the leading battalion had crossed over the canal and into Egypt, 250 miles away.
Was there any trouble at the time of your leaving?
My brother at that time was a battery commander in the Arab Legion, and he with his Arab troops, entered into Palestine from the other direction. And I always like to say that he showed us rather vigorously, but I don't think he did, in fact. But we knew each other were there on the opposite sides. No, I mean, we had a very peaceful, nobody interfered with us on our way down. The Jews were really too interested in fighting, well, they were concerned with fighting the Arabs. There was no point in fighting us because we were leaving.
This, I think, was May 1948.
About then, yes.
What's happened to you after Palestine?
I stayed in Egypt on the brigade headquarters for a bit. And went home again. I'm just trying to get it in order. Went home again. I got married in December 1948. And we went to Ballykenna, the training centre of the North Irish Brigade, where I was adjutant. And I then decided that my chances of promotion within the regiment were very slender. There's a one particular officer who since died, who commanded a battalion of Indian infantry at the age of 22 in Italy. And so I transferred to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, where I spent the rest of my career in the Army, retiring 5 years early in 1971 when I was 50.